House Committee on Rules come to order for Wednesday, May 29, 2013. We're going to start out of order and open up a work session on House Bill 3528. Ms. Seiler, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3528 was heard on May 20th. It is the measure that exempts registered lobbyists from reporting to Oregon Government Ethics Commission for money spent on lobbying other registered lobbyists. We have a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact on the measure, and no amendments to the measure.
Well, are there any questions about the bill? We're in work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 3528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves House Bill 3528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Bill is moved, and do we have a carrier? I will carry the bill. That's fine. Close the work session on House Bill 3528. Open a work session on House Bill 2597.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2597 was originally heard on April 8th. It is a measure that directs the Public Officials Compensation Commission to make recommendations on salaries of elected officials, including senators and representatives. It disconnects the judicial salaries and the legislative salaries and directed the Legislative Assembly to consider recommendations in their budget. You have a -2 amendment that removes the requirement that the governor include the commission's recommendations on salaries in the budget report provided by the governor, and removes the direction of the Public Officials Compensation Commission to meet. It will only disconnect the judicial salaries from the legislative salaries. There is a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And
Mr. Campbell?
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. As you'll note, there's an amendment to the bill, and let me explain why that amendment is there. With the changes to the Public Officials Compensation Commission came a fiscal impact that we were not able to reduce. In order for the most important part of the bill to move forward without the fiscal and without you having to send it to Ways and Means, we will support the amendment. We don't have an intention at this point to activate in any way the Public Official Compensation Commission. We would like to discuss that in the future because we do believe it has the potential to play an important role in the future, just not today. And so, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support the bill with the amendment that's been suggested.
So this allows us to raise judicial salaries without the politically disastrous step of raising our own salaries. Is that correct?
That's right, Mr. Chair. Thank
okay.
you.
Any questions for Mr. Campbell? -2 amendment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? To be determined. Thanks, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendment to House Bill 2597.
Senator Hicks moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 2597. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm having a little problem understanding. I'm having a little problem understanding how we end up with a fiscal, because the governor's told he needs to include this in his budget report. I think that's all his language that comes out does.
Mr. Campbell, can you speak to that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's an excellent question, Representative Barnhart. And the reality is I was surprised when the fiscal came in as well, because the statute does seem to indicate there is a current role and responsibility for the commission. However, what I understand in further conversations that is that, in fact, the Public Official Compensation Commission does not meet, is not funded to meet, and does not accomplish any.
That answers my question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart.
Is there further discussion on the motion to adopt the -2 amendment? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2597 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves House Bill 2597 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have to be a no on this. And the no is not so much a protest one way or another in relationship to whether legislators should be in some way or another married to the judicial department as far as their salaries are concerned. But instead, a no, which many, I think, legislators find hard to make, a position many legislators find hard to take, and that is, to justify their own salaries while they are members of the legislature, for fear that they're going to get branded with the salaries that are somewhat in keeping with what the United States congressmen perhaps make in a far different world than we happen to live in. Basically, I think, maybe it's appropriate that it be like that, but fundamentally, none of us are worth a dang bit more than we think we're worth. And if we only think we're worth the pauper's pittance that currently is paid to legislators, I don't know, maybe that's all we're worth then. But at any rate, I do think that the salaries that are paid for legislators are inadequate to open the door for many qualified people who just simply cannot afford to take a pass on a living wage job to come to the state legislature for a full-time job that pays less than a good part-time job would pay. So as a protest to our own positions that we've taken, I'm going to have to be a no on this, and my apologies for it, but I just feel very strongly about it.
Understood. Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, at the risk of stating the completely obvious, tying these two jobs together in the way the current law does sinks the possibility of giving the judges a raise. It might even have a negative impact on the issue that Representative Jensen raises, because these are so different and they really require different considerations. I'll be a strong supporter of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the motion to move the floor with the due pass recommendation? Any objection other than Representative Jensen? Okay, motion carries. Bill passes, and Representative Jensen's objection is noted for the record.
Is he a no on the bill?
Pardon?
So, Mr. Chair, in the official record, he will be a no
yes.
on the bill.
Yeah, he'll be a no on the bill.
Thank you.
Should we reopen for Hoyle?
Do
we
have
to wait?
Yes.
I'm going to do a motion to reopen.
Yes,
suspend the rules so she can vote.
Yep.
Which bill? Suspend the rules on 35 so that she can vote.
Mr.
On 35.
Chair,
oh, okay.
I move that the rules be suspended and Representative Hoyle be allowed to vote on House Bill 3528.
Representative Berger moves the rules be suspended for purpose of allowing Representative Hoyle to vote on House Bill 3528. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hoyle, how do you vote?
Aye.
Hoyle
Thank
votes
you.
Aye. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2597.
Carry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you coming. Same motion for Holby.
Holby? Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't know if I can get this script. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and Representative Holby be allowed to vote on House Bill 3528.
Representative Berger moves the rules be suspended so that Representative Holby can vote on House Bill 3528. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Holby, how do you vote?
Aye.
Holby votes aye. And I think did I close the work session on? So 2597, so we didn't assign a carrier, but it will be Representative Hicks. Next, we'll open a work session on House Bill 3499.
And And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3499 was heard on May 1st, and we had a work session on May 22nd, at which time we adopted the Dash 4 amendment to the measure. The Dash 4 amendment requires notice of sale of home to include statement that some residential property sold at trustee sale may have been used in the manufacturing of methamphetamines, chemical components of which are known to be toxic. Prospective purchasers of residential property should be aware of this potential danger before deciding to place a bid for this property at the trustee sale. We did not have the fiscal and revenue statement at the time we adopted the measure amendment. We do have it now. It's a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the measure as it stands.
Okay, so again, we adopted the amendment. Thanks again to Representative Berger, Representative Whitsett for bringing the bill and working on a compromise. Representative Hicks?
Yes, so OLIS does not reflect that the amendment was adopted, but we're absolutely certain that it was.
We are absolutely certain it was adopted. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that clarification. So we need a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3499 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 3499 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Whitsett will carry the bill, please. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3499. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3506.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure was originally heard on May 1st. The measure, as written, requires Secretary of State and county clerks to provide voting materials in language other than English to minority language speakers in counties in which 5% of the population or 10,000 citizens are members of a single language minority community. You have a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure and establishes a task force on minority language voting materials. The task force is to consist of 6 to 9 members that includes the Secretary of State, or designee, the Director of Elections Division, or designee, 1 senator, 1 representative, and 2 county clerks. 1 to 3 additional appointments may be made based on the expertise in language issues, community organization, or population analysis. Task force shall determine best way to ensure that members of large language minority communities receive necessary voter materials and the applicable material and the applicable language. Specifies elements of the analysis that the task force is to conduct. Requires task force to report to interim committee on rules no later than October 1, 2014. Directs Secretary of State to provide staff support for the task force. This measure does have subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There's a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact measure on the amendment.
Mr. Do I have to wait for you to say?
I don't. Is there any comment, discussion on the bill? Yes.
Did I gather that the amendment had or had not been adopted?
Has not.
Had not.
Has not been.
Mm-hmm. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3506.
Representative Hoyle moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3506. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none. Motion carries, and the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3506, as amended, with a due pass recommendation, and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 3506, as amended, with a due pass recommendation, and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion on the motion?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kenner, and then we'll come back to you.
Yeah, I don't support the motion. I just want to make that clear.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, even I'm not supportive of the bill even in its amended form. It frankly seems backward to me. I mean, if we need to get access to the materials and voting, I think we could probably do better just to provide translation services on an as-needed basis. I don't know. There's so many questions that are not answered yet in my mind that I'm not prepared to support even the movement of it.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Yes. The amendment proposes a task force. I know this is going to Ways and Means, and that's in their purview, but I think there is an embedded policy statement in here, and I'm not going to support the motion either.
All right. Any further discussion? Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do support this concept, and from our discussion during the public hearing, it was clear that there were some questions about implementation. This task force seems to be a good way to get those worked out. and I look forward to seeing what they come up with.
Further discussion? Let's have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Holdy.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Kenemer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 3506. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3523.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3523 was heard on May 8th. We bring it back before you today with several amendments. The measure requires statements of independent expenditures to be filed with Secretary of State using an electronic filing system, applies filing deadlines to additional statements of independent expenditures, requires campaign finance statement to be filed within 2 business days if contribution equaling or exceeding $1,000 is received during the 14-day period immediately preceding the election. It adjusts other deadlines for campaign finance statements. Requires candidate, political committee, or petition committee that makes expenditure that must be reported by candidate or committee as in-kind contribution to provide written notice of expenditure to candidate or committee who benefits from that expenditure. Requires candidate or committee to give notice not later than 48 hours after that original expenditure is reported in the electronic filing system maintained by the Secretary of State. The measure becomes operative September 19th, 2013. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have a dash one amendment, which is an amendment to make a couple technical changes that were identified during drafting. It applies changes in contribution and expenditures reporting to committees with unexpended balance upon filing statement of organization after exceeding the $750 reporting minimum. Changes business day to calendar day, that was omitted in one section, and changes the operative date to January 1, 2014. You have a dash three amendment. The dash three amendment deletes unfulfilled pledge, subscription, or agreement, or promise to make contribution from definition of contribution. You have a dash four amendment, which deletes requirement that candidate or political committee submit bank account number when reporting contributions and expenditures. And you have a dash seven amendment, which requires campaign finance statement to be filed within 2 business days after a contribution is received that brings the aggregate amount of contributions received from a single donor during the period to $1,000 or more to report within 2 business days in that 14-day period preceding the election. All of these measures independently have a minimal expenditure on each measure or each amendment before you. There is a cumulative impact to the Secretary of State, so we have been asked to send this to Ways and Means so they can consider the cumulative impact of all these changes.
Thank you. Is Kevin Neely here?
Yes.
Come, do you want to speak to the amendments?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. How are you? Committee members, I think the last time I was here, we discussed most of those amendments.
Get your name, please, sir.
Oh, Kevin Neely. I am the president of CNE Systems. Thanks. The amendment to eliminate, there's some basic kind of housekeeping amendment. That's the first one, as the committee administrator described. There's an amendment in there that gets rid of pledges. I've talked about that to several of you many sessions now, and I always seem to put it in the wrong bill. We'll see if I did that again this time. Pledges are really, in my view, one of the last gray areas that's really gray area in the election law. Very few people actually report pledges, and with the accelerated timelines, it seemed like a good thing to remove from the law. The third amendment is really innocuous, and that removes the requirement that the Secretary of State's office collects bank account information. Right now, they have to collect the account number, and that is a tremendous problem when you're trying to create a committee, especially if you're a volunteer treasurer trying to create a committee. There's a little bit of a cart and horse issue. The bank wants to know what your committee number is, and the Secretary of State wants to know what your bank account number is. And so it's a huge problem for folks to be able to actually open the bank account that they have to have in order to create the political action committee. In this way, you can report to the Secretary of State's office what bank you're using, go out, get your bank account opened up, and move forward with the activation of your political committee. It will make things tremendously easy to get the committee up and running. And the last amendment is an amendment that I suggested. I don't have the bill, the underlying bill adds $1,000 contributions to 48-hour reporting, I shouldn't say that, to calendar day reporting. That bill was brought to you by some of the other members in the chamber. I recommended to them that they include amounts that aggregate over that $1,000 because you don't want to have a situation where someone gives $999.99 120 times in the last 13 days of the election, totaling, you know, $100,000. That would be bad. And none of that would be reported on the 48-hour or two-calendar day regime. The amendment, after a little tweaking, does appear to do that. And what it says is if someone gives up to $1,000, so if they give $500 and then an additional $500, that second $500 would trigger that two-calendar day reporting. And then if they gave any additional funds, be those either in-kind or cash contributions, after that, within that 14-day period before the election, any additional amount would need to be reported within two calendar days. So that's my summary.
Thank you very much, Representative Berger.
Yeah, question, please, and this may be for Aaron, on the dash threes. That is the one that removes the pledge, I believe. But then at the end, there are specific details on implementation, and it says becomes operative September 19th. Is that because of the filing deadlines for the...
The September 19th deadline was part of the original bill. The dash one amendment replaces that when we adopt it. It will replace that and it will be just January 1, 2014.
But if we adopt the dash?
The last one amended gets adopted, takes over the language. So we'll adopt the dash one, we'll replace that language.
Okay. So if we... Let me get this straight. So if we would have to take it in a certain order.
Correct.
And that be so the dash one would have to be the last one adopted or that language would
correct.
Be got it.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to get that on the record because I do want to get rid of the pledges, but I was unsure of that language. Thank you.
Are there any yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a definition for independent expenditure?
We might want to call the Secretary of State's office forward, if they could help us out with that. I know there is a statutory definition, but I can't quote it from memory.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. And the definition of independent expenditure is an expenditure by a person for communication in support or opposition to a clearly identified candidate or measure that is not made with the cooperation or with prior consent or a consultation with at the request or suggestion of a candidate or any authorized committee.
Thank you. Representative Jensen, is there? Do you have further questions?
I'm aware of the definition. And the one concern I have with the bill is there are some folks who might make some contributions to a campaign. Be that for a individual or be that a ballot measure or an initiative type of thing, that do not normally fall into this category of understanding all of the gibberish that we have published over the last few years in relationship to campaign finance laws. And I have concern that some of these people may get burned with fines / penalties for violation of this particular statute and when it was a perfectly innocent thing on their part. I understand this. I don't necessarily always agree with all of the things that we have in our campaign expenditures, but I understand when we're talking about a candidate or when we're talking about a committee for a ballot measure type of thing, we're dealing with folks who certainly should become familiar and are aware or should be aware of, you know, what the laws provide or state. But I'm not sure all my citizens out there do, and I hate to see them get caught in the bind on this. So while I'll support the motion today, I still have grave concern about that as far as just Mr. and Ms. Average Oregonian, who is maybe making their first step into political activity of one form or another. So.
Thank you for those comments. Any questions for the panel before we let them go? Thank you both very much. So we have a series of amendments to adopt. Are you sure? Is this first? So, okay. Yep. Representative Hoyle?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 3523.
Excuse me. Vice Chair Hoyle moves to adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 3523. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 3523.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 3523. Is there objection? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -7 amendment to House Bill 3523.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves to adopt the -7 amendment to House Bill 3523. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3523.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3523. Is there any discussion? Any objection? No. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3523 as amended with a due pass recommendation and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 3523 as amended with a due pass recommendation and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there further discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, I did understand from Ms. Seiler that this does have a fiscal and that's why it's going to. Thank you.
That's right. Any further discussion? Representative Hicks?
I have no discussion.
Oh, I thought you raised your hand. Sorry. Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Bill is referred. Close the work session on House Bill 3523.
Roy? Okay, we're going to, just 1 second.
I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2887.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2887 was originally heard on March 4th. This is the measure that prescribes the process for adjudicating reapportionment of congressional districts, forms a panel of judges to decide upon reapportionment in the event the Legislative Assembly fails to act on reapportionment or upon petition challenging reapportionment enacted by the Legislative Assembly. You have a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment establishes timeline for filing of petitions, location for filing, and provides for consolidation of multiple petitions, specifies pleading requirements for party filing petition with court, specifies process for selection of panel judges, and allows for panel to appoint a special master, determine scope of review for legislatively approved plan, no plan, or vetoed plan, determine scope of review for appeals of panel plans to Supreme Court, including provides for de novo review for non-unanimous panel plan. You have a, if you did not print it out, there is a calendar, a timeline that shows the process for what happens if a plan is challenged, and it spells out the timeline that is contained within that amendment, and I have copies that I will pass out. Mr. Roy Pulvers is on the phone, and I believe Mr. DiLorenzo is here, and Dan Gilbert.
Is Mr. Miller going to testify?
He's not.
Okay. Thank you for that overview. Just as this is a bill I brought forward this session as a result of my experience with redistricting to give clarity where none currently exists about how congressional redistricting dispute should be resolved if the legislature fails to complete the task in a manner that the governor approves. So with that in mind, I'd like to ask Mr. DiLorenzo to come to the table. And Mr. Pulvers is on the phone. And just by way of introduction, after introducing the bill, which was really meant to be a conversation starter, we had work group discussions that Ms. Seiler facilitated involving Mr. DiLorenzo and Mr. Pulvers representing the major political parties in the effort to achieve a product that everybody feels is fair and they can be comfortable with. So please come forward. And
Mr. Chair, may I invite Judge Hazelton up to help bolster?
Yes, and thank you for reminding me that he was here.
Bruce. Yeah. I thought the judge was here, too.
No, he's not.
Bruce, come on up.
Mr. Miller from the Judicial Department. Judge Hazelton, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, was also involved in crafting this.
I guess not. Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and actually I am here in my own personal capacity at the invitation of your chair to help design a process that would be fair. My experience spans over 30 years, I guess, in congressional redistricting litigation. 30 years ago, I represented one of the major parties in federal court. 10 years ago in state court, and then most recently, had nothing to do because of the miracle that resulted by the legislature reapportioning itself and reapportioning the congressional districts. I would like to give a 50,000-foot view of what is a consensus product that has been generated by your work group. But first, I'd like to thank the work group, Judge Hazelton, Bruce Miller, and Roy Pulvers and Dan Gilbert made major contributions to designing this product and working through how it would work in process and in practice. I also want to thank Aaron Seiler, who did a wonderful job not only scheduling us but helping structure our deliberations. And thank you very much, Aaron. It was a pleasure to work with you. The legislation was designed to address three issues that crops up in congressional redistricting litigation. First is the race to the courthouse. Second was timing issues that created the prospects of federal court intervention. And third were the perceptions of fairness or unfairness, depending upon your perspective and which congressional district's judge was deciding the case. What you have before you are the Dash 1 amendments. First of all, on process, page 1, line 11, there are provisions that allow any registered voter to challenge the legislatively adopted reapportionment plan or to request a reapportionment of congressional districts if there is no plan adopted. At line 19 of the first page, you'll find that the Secretary of State is made the respondent in these cases. We chose the Secretary of State because she is the person who must conduct the elections, and so she is the person who most naturally would be issued the order from the court saying, conduct the election this way with these boundaries. On the next page, page 2, one of the highlights at line 17 is the manner by which a panel is adopted. One judge from each congressional district serves on the judicial panel. That guarantees sensitivity to the needs of every single portion of the state as opposed to the present system. Page 3, line 2, there is a provision that allows the court, the Chief Justice, to appoint a special master if the amount of evidence is voluminous and if it would be inconvenient for the entire panel to travel or to otherwise gather evidence. On page 4,
There are provisions for an appeal to the Supreme Court from the decision of the five-judge panel. The Supreme Court has two different standards. One is if there is a unanimous panel decision. If there's a unanimous panel decision, the Supreme Court is to take a look at the product and determine whether it complies with the state, federal constitution, and also statutes, and if so, to approve it. If there is a split decision by the judicial panel, then the Supreme Court is to try the case anew, but based on the record that was produced down at the lower court level. And that language you can find at page 5, lines 2 through 12. And then the rest of the bill has to do with operative dates and decision timelines, all designed to ensure that there is a new plan in place by January 1 to precede the filing deadlines in March. And we have done our best to run through this over and over and over again. We think this is a very good product. It's one that ensures predictability. It provides litigators a pretty good map of the, so they understand the rules of the road, and we commend it for your considerations.
Thank you very much.
The judicial department may have some.
Mr. Miller, do you want to
also?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the office for the state court administrator. As you all know, the Judicial Department does not typically take a stand on policy bills, and we are neutral on this, but we take great interest in procedures before the court. And when we were invited by the chair to review this and make sure that we could come up with procedures that would work in the court setting, we were happy to help, and that's been the extent of my involvement in this process. And I'm happy if you want more detail on how the process goes, I'm here to answer your questions.
All right, thank you. And I want to give Mr. Pulvers a chance to weigh in. Roy Pulvers joining us by phone.
Thank you, Chair Garrett. My name is Roy Pulvers, P-U-L-V-E-R-S. I'm a lawyer and a partner in the Portland office of the law firm Hinshaw and Culbertson, and I'm a lawyer for the Democratic Party of Oregon. I wanted to echo John DiLorenzo's thanks to the chair for initiating this, and to Aaron Seiler and Dan Gilbert and Chief Judge Hazelton and Bruce Miller and John DiLorenzo. It all provided really significant, thoughtful, cooperative effort in pulling this together. And I think at the end of the day, what we have is a nonpartisan, fair, clear, and useful bill in the wake of the successful legislative achievement of a bipartisan plan for state and federal redistricting and reapportionment after the 2010 census. It's a good time to look ahead, and Chair Garrett was thoughtful and prescient to do that and to try to constructively address certain issues. And I won't go back through the outline of the bill that John provided, but I wanted to focus on one particular thing that was, I think, of particular importance from my perspective, and that is, I think the bill strikes the right balance between the legislature and the courts and between the trial panel and the Supreme Court. And in the first instance, it recognizes that if the legislature does in fact adopt a plan, and if the governor approves that plan without veto, the courts must defer to that plan in the event that they conclude that it conforms to the statutes and to the relevant constitutional standards. That is, the courts don't have the authority to substitute their own judgment for what might be a better plan or a plan that they think conforms more robustly to the standards in the law. So long as what the legislature did is lawful, the courts are obliged to affirm it. And I think that's a very important principle that we developed in this bill and carried through the bill. And as between the trial panel and the Supreme Court, again, by virtue of having established a trial panel with statewide distribution, what the bill provides that in the event that the trial panel unanimously concludes that a particular plan is it conforms to statutes and the Constitution, the Supreme Court is obliged to, again, affirm that plan and not, again, sort of go through the drill of trying to figure out whether it can fashion a plan that it thinks is conforms better in some manner to the law. So it recognizes, in the first instance, the primacy of the legislature, and in the second instance, the value of having a statewide trial panel, and in each instance gives appropriate deference to their decisions when the deference is due. So that's one thing I wanted to highlight for the committee. And apart from that, I'm pleased to answer any questions that there may be, and again, express my appreciation.
Thanks very much. Are there any questions for any of the three? Representative Hicks.
Regarding jurisdiction, so this assigns jurisdiction to the Circuit Court initially and then the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon. It sounds like at one point you did handle a case in federal court. And so what are the circumstances in which a redistricting dispute could wind up in federal court?
Sure. Representative Garrett and Vice Chair Hicks, years ago, most of the congressional redistricting cases were filed in federal court. And the case we handled quite a few years ago had to do with a circumstance in which the House and the Senate were in opposite hands and could not come to a resolution. The Speaker of the House, during the interim, appointed a special joint committee to try to design a compromise plan. The committee succeeded in devising the compromise plan, but the Senate would not adopt it. And so the Federal District Court just adopted the Joint Committee's recommendation. Last time we were involved in federal district litigation, a Supreme Court case had intervened. It's called the Grew case. And basically, the Grew case instructs the federal courts that although they have concurrent jurisdiction, they are to defer to the state processes that are in place unless it becomes apparent that the state cannot redistrict in time. And if that is the case, then the federal courts always have concurrent jurisdiction to make sure that no election is held under an unconstitutional apportionment. But if it appears that the state processes, whatever you here design, can work in time, then the federal courts are to defer to the state processes.
Okay, one follow-up. Sounds like under the Grew case, then, which is what's changed since the last time this was litigated in federal court, under the Grew case, then, this is the final answer, basically. There's not going to be a person who can file a case in federal court and then get jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I believe that is an accurate statement.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You probably said something like this, but I just want to make certain that I understand. These dates look suspiciously familiar to me, but looking at the constitutional provisions for how redistricting of the legislature is done in the event that the legislature is unable to pass a law to do it. Is my memory reasonably decent in respect to this issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it is, and I'll defer to Mr. Miller to elaborate on that because many of those dates, in fact, did come from existing processes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we did try to make this track state line redistricting or reapportionment with the same time frames. It just made sense to us, given the pressures on the Secretary of State to get this implemented, that we ought to try to track as closely as possible so that it all comes in at the same time. Having said that, it's important to recognize the burden that you're putting on the Supreme Court by adding this process in there. Now, that's not necessarily a problem for you or me at this point in time, but it will be a budget problem for us in the 2021-23 session to address how do we make sure that we have proper funding to do all of this.
Fair point. Further discussion, Representative Denbrough, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the the twin paths that the Supreme Court can take. You know, if one of the members of the initial panel doesn't agree with the others, then the Supreme Court has the authority to retry the case. Is there precedent for that? I mean, that seems like a pretty minimal threshold, you know, just anything less than a unanimous decision.
Mr. Chair
and Representative Dembro, this is Roy Bulvers, and under the current sort of rules of appellate practice, there are a class of cases in which the Oregon appellate courts have discretionary authority to take the record that was developed in the trial court and to consider it fresh without any deference to factual findings that were made below. And that's the general framework that we thought would make sense here. That is, that the Supreme Court isn't obliged to consider the record anew. The record won't change regardless. It's the same record. They will have the authority, at least, if there's less than unanimous decision, should the court decide to do so, should a majority of the Supreme Court decide to do so, to make its own findings of fact. And I think that's probably authority that should be inherent in the Supreme Court on a redistricting question of redistricting. And we felt that this was an okay trigger because, conversely, we were tying their hands in the event that there was a unanimous decision by a statewide trial panel. So the purpose was to recognize the importance of the trial panel process and to give it some value in the process so that you didn't just go through the entire drill again in the Supreme Court. And it's also a way of, as Mr. Gilbert was mentioning, conserving the Supreme Court's resources and allowing the Supreme Court to make a decision with very serious time constraints about where it was going to put its time and energy. And as you know, the getting your arms around a record in a reapportionment case or a redistricting case is extremely time-consuming and difficult and complicated. And we felt that it was important to give the Supreme Court the most possible latitude to determine whether and under what circumstances they would exercise their discretion to revisit findings of fact. So this doesn't require them to do it. It just gives them the latitude to do it in the event that they feel that it's necessary.
And Mr. Chair, John DiLorenzo again for the record. If I can add to that explanation for Representative Dembro's, to address his question, if there is a split decision, it means that a judge from a particular congressional district does not agree that the plan is optimal. Because in politics, perception is reality, and because one of the goals of this legislation is to address perception issues and to make clear that the process is fair, we thought the fairest way to proceed, if one or more congressional districts' judges thought the plan was less than optimal, would be to try the case anew de novo on the record. It would be very difficult to raise fairness questions in that case. And so it was with fairness in mind that and the perception of fairness that we designed that strategy. But we invented it. I mean, there's no real precedent for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Anything further for our witnesses? All right. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And to all of you, again, thank you very much for the work you put in. I doubt you were able to bill anybody for this, but the public appreciates it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pulvers, for joining us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did receive a fiscal statement just a few minutes ago, and I'm getting ready to post it on OLIS. And just to reinforce what Mr. Miller said, that there is no fiscal impact for the next several bienniums. They don't anticipate a fiscal impact until 2021. Currently, they estimate the rough cost would be about $230,000 per case, but thinking in this time frame of money, but 10 years from now. So that's what the fiscal statement will say, is basically there is no impact until 2021, and they're using estimates from last time that the Supreme Court potentially was involved to estimate the cost. We do not have a revenue impact statement quite yet. Hopefully it'll come in shortly.
So what we can do at this time is adopt the amendment and wait on further paperwork to do anything further.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 2887.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2887. Is there a discussion on the motion? Hearing none. Is there objection? Hearing none. So ordered. The motion, the bill is amended. Close the work session on House Bill 2887. Are we? We're going to stand at ease for a few minutes. come back to order, please?
To the big bad wolf. So, actually, no.
For those waiting on House Bill 3309, we're not going to work that bill today. Our intention is to work that bill tomorrow. We don't have a meeting time scheduled yet, so we're just going to have to stay tuned. We'll let you know as soon as we can identify a time for the committee to meet. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3452.
3309. Yeah, we'll get you another chair. Yeah. You got one already. Yes, sir. Members of the committee, House Bill 34 describes circumstances in which gray wolves may be taken.
So who'd like to start? Representative Jensen, do you want to kick us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, just briefly, and then to hear the other folks here. My name is Bob Jensen. I am state representative from House District 58. House District 58 begins just west of Pendleton in Umatilla County, and extends to the Idaho border. I have often made the claim that representation in the state legislature should be on the basis of per acre rather than per person. Unfortunately, the folks from Multnomah County didn't seem to understand that formula. So, at any rate, House Bill 3452, with the attachment B, I think that you have, which will be an amendment to the original bill, and will basically replace most of the original bill, is the product and work of, might I say, about a decade on the part of a lot of people, a lot of different interest groups. And it was with some enthusiasm when this legislative session began that the governor weighed in and wanted a work group to work on this bill, and Brett Johnscombe was the individual who led that work group, or at least I think led the work group and reported to the executive department. And rarely, but occasionally, he even reported to me when he had something good to say. The problem originates a few years ago when the decision was made to reintroduce wolves into the natural environment that we have in the state of Oregon. Wolves are, by their very nature, a predator, and they are a very good predator. They're very good hunters, and they're capable of taking down animals significantly larger than they are, and therefore represented something of a major concern and a major problem to the stock growing industry in the state of Oregon. And to perhaps a few other individuals as well. But since that time, we have been working with the folks who were most active, I suppose, in the efforts to reintroduce them, working with the livestock producers, and the executive department, the governor's office, trying to come up with some solutions. Originally, originally there was a rather lengthy, both in terms of time of preparation and in terms of pages, report now known as the Wolf Plan that was adopted by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and met with the approval of the legislature. And we have moved on from there. So let me make a comment about the senators who are on my immediate right. Senator Dinkelder and I have fought a number of battles, sometimes against the rest of you Philistines and sometimes with each other. Over a period of more than a decade, if memory serves me correctly, and it's been a very, I think, progressive and good relationship that we've had, and her contribution and work to and support of this plan has been critical to us, and I'd like to ask her to say a few words. And then we have the new senator, the junior senator, or I guess we only have one per district at any rate. We have Senator Hansel, who has just joined us in the legislature this session. And he has had a quick introduction to the wolf issue and the wolf plan. Senator Hansel is a farmer. But he's kind of avoided having to worry about the wolf plan because he's kept himself as a dryland wheat farmer for the most part. At any rate, both of them have, I think, some comments they'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, state senator from District 29. Which I think currently has all the wolf packs in Oregon located within the boundaries of the district. There may be some in Ted Ferrioli's district, but for right now, I think we certainly have the majority of them. Prior to my taking office, I was a 30-year county commissioner in Umatilla County. So as the wolf plan began to develop, I had the opportunity to work on it from a county perspective as the predation committees were put together, the wolf committees, and we followed the example of Wallowa County and pretty well adopted their procedures, and it was working well for them. Then as I was campaigning for this office, spent Wallowa County, certainly in the district, and had the opportunity to meet with folks throughout the area. We now have PACs in Umatilla County as well. And one of the critical issues facing the constituents that I was hoping to represent and now do was wolf predation. And the wolf plan had been put together, and then there was a court case, and then that was put on hold. And in the meantime, particularly the one pack, the MNAHA pack, and the predation that they had begun to do, and the learning behavior of preying on certain kinds of animals, i.e., in this case, livestock, that was being taught then to their pups, and became very clear that we needed to have that management tool back into the toolbox. So I wanted to make it a priority for me as representing my district when I took office, and was very fortunate to be placed on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee in the Senate under my colleague Senator Dingfelter's leadership. And early on in the session, invited her to come out to the district, if she would, and we would spend time in Wallowa County. She very graciously agreed to do that, and we spent time out there together, meeting with the producers, meeting with a variety of groups, the predation committee, the commissioners, a group that was very... I don't know if there was an official name, but folks that felt that the wolves needed to be a part of the environment, more of the wolf supporters, and with the governor's staff and ODF&W. So it was a very productive weekend. We all were educated.
standing up on the divide, looking out over the Zumwalt prairies and other things, seeing what the issues were. It was a very great educational experience for us. And we came back all committed to trying to put together something that would work for the different parties involved. I also want to call out Brett and his work in the negotiations representing the governor's office, and we wouldn't be here today were it not for his leadership. Also the cattlemen and their willingness to come to the table, and the environmental groups that had actually sued the state. We're here before you today, I think, at the moving ahead, a very collaborative, bipartisan, bicameral, all the different good things that we in Oregon are known to do as far as getting good public policy. So we're here in support of the bill. We realize that the amendments in the bills are still being written. We're pleased that it's here. I am personally, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to offer my support, and hopefully that we'll be able to move this forward, and it'll have a very positive place and impact, not only in District 29, but throughout the state.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Senator Jackie Dingfelder from District 23, one of the geographically small districts. However, we hold our own with a number of constituents, and it's a really an honor to be here with my colleagues. I'd like to echo some of the comments that have been made already regarding this is a, let's just say, a long time coming. I think Representative Jensen and I have been working on wolf issues for over a decade, probably, from when we first heard about the wolves in Idaho. I don't think they were quite in Oregon yet when we started listening to concerns about how we would manage the wolf when they did finally come to Oregon, and obviously they did. And we were fortunate because we actually had the foresight to develop a wolf management plan with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, with a lot of input from folks around the state. However, as you heard, issues occurred, and actually dealing with the wolf depredation on the ground has been a challenge for everybody involved. And so I think we're all learning. We're learning how to live with wolves. We're learning how to deal with problem wolves. We're trying to deal with how we can grow the population in a way that's sustainable, but also not impinging on certain ways of life. And of course, it's been a challenge because wolf were eradicated, in the 1950s, or I should say extirpated, in the 1950s, and that was done purposely. I mean, a lot of it was through, wolves were a problem, and for certain ways of life. And so when we knew wolves were coming back, we said, how are we going to deal with the population coming back to Oregon? So, the good Senator Hansel mentioned, we spent 3 days, the three of us together in Eastern Oregon, met with folks on all sides of the issue and the tribes, both the Nez Perce and the Umatilla, and the Warm Springs, I should say, all three tribes. And it was very helpful also to hear a tribal perspective. We heard from folks on the ground. We heard from folks in the community. We heard some of the things that were working and that some weren't. We heard about the wolf compensation policies, and Representative Jensen and I were on the Ways and Means Committee when we adopted the Wolf Compensation Fund, and there was a wolf tax credit. So there's been a progression over the years. As you heard, there was a lawsuit, and that's where the stalemate came. And I just want to give credit to folks sitting beside me on both sides, because it was 17 months of work through the settlement process. It was because of the commitment of everybody here in the room and the four of us up here to continue working together. And as you've already heard, the governor's office was instrumental. I want to thank Brett for he probably spent a good chunk of his life on the phone with probably any one of us and people in this room talking about ways to move forward. So obviously, we don't have the amendment yet. It still needs to be vetted by all of us and different parties. But the concept, I believe that we're in agreement on the concept, and we're looking forward to seeing the amendment and would ask for your consideration of that. And with that, I'd like to pass it off to Brett maybe to talk specifics about I guess you're on a short leash here because they don't move any further. But I again want to thank my colleagues, good colleagues from Eastern Oregon, for being willing to sit together and work patiently through this process, because we started talking about this obviously in February, and here we are, it's practically June, and as we know, good things don't come quickly, but patience sometimes pays off. So I appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this. Brett, I'll hand it off to you.
Okay. Chair Garrett and Co-Chairs Hicks and Hoyle, for the record, Brett Brownscombe with Governor Kitzhaber's office. So I've been staffing the governor on the wolf issue for since my time began, and I think folks here to my right have been working on this issue for far longer than that, and it's thank you for the hearing. It seems always a brave act to have a hearing on wolves, and thankfully this time around I think what you'll hear, knock on wood, is that there, from folks that are in the audience and certainly at this table, that we've reached a point of consensus on an issue that otherwise often comes to this legislative body without consensus. And so before I get into the just details on the amendment that would be coming forward, the backdrop has been explained here is there was litigation filed that held up the state's wolf plan and prevented the state, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who's also in the audience and I know would like to make some comments about the settlement and what it means for the state Fish and Wildlife Management. The litigation prevented the state from using the wolf plan's authority to lethally remove wolves that were chronically depredating on livestock. This went on for well over a period of years. There were many wolf-killed livestock depredations out in Wallowa County during the time period of the litigation, causing tensions to grow significantly there. And the only recourse that landowners really had was there was a compensation fund, which was passed by the legislative body in 2011. And so at the very least, if the legislature continues to fund the compensation program, the producers who lost cattle had recourse through compensation. But it was also very clear that that kind of a management approach where you've got a chronically depredating pack and the only recourse is compensation wasn't going to be satisfactory, A, to producers, but B, to the long-term interest in promoting tolerance for wolves as they recover across the state. And so we stepped in based on the initial interest of the parties in exploring settlement talks. The governor's office stepped in to try to see if there was a bridge that could be built to get out of the litigation, get back to managing wolves, not just with lethal means, but certainly including that, but also through non-lethal conflict deterrence practices. And we knew all of this would take legislation to clarify that the state has the authority to lethally manage wolves. It would also take a lot of agreement amongst the parties of the case, the Oregon Cattle Association, Oregon Wild, Cascadia Wildlands, and the primary defendant, the state, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I would like to just reflect the thanks and the trip that the senators and Representative Jensen took out to Wallowa County in April was, I think, a very key moment to bringing this all together. It showed the commitment on the part of the legislative body to finding a solution on this. And the senators and Rep. Jensen were out there on a fairly cold, blustery day on the divide.
It was snowing.
And and amongst a lot of producers who had been losing wolves as you know recently as that month. And it was, I think, a time for, you know, when you're living far, far from Salem and for three legislators, prominent legislators, to come out and indicate that there's an interest in the issue and what's happening out in Wallowa County on the wolf recovery side as well as the livestock protection side. It was very significant for people to see that. And
it made an impact on the parties to the litigation. So I wanted to thank each of you for doing that and coming out. And Representative, for your pursuit of this bill and legislation on this issue, including not just this year, but past years when it was met with less rousing acceptance. So as we move forward on this, the settlement involves some critical components, and one component is legislation, and that's what is before this committee in House Bill 3452 with amendments that were promised are coming soon. And the other piece of the settlement is agreement by all the parties to a rule that would be promulgated into permanent rule by the Department of Fish and Wildlife at its upcoming commission meeting, likely this summer. The other piece of the settlement was agreement about what to do about the Mnaha Pack because of the ongoing continued depredations. So there were many days when I thought it would never happen, but the parties, to their credit, all showed, I think, a very high degree of commitment to working out their interests on what they needed, whether it be for wolf protection and recovery or for livestock and property protection, or on the state's end for science-based wildlife management and that is responsive and responsible. I think all the parties really came together and kept those interests in mind and were willing to think about how to meet those interests without litigation going to its final end, which would have been an opinion that resulted in, and we're not sure how it would have or would go. It would result in the adversarial outcome of one party stands to gain and zero sum gain, and then the other party on the other end loses all. And so I think this settlement represents a fairly landmark historic moment where a lot of parties who typically have not been able to come to agreement on this issue did, and to their credit, saw that settlement was the best way forward instead of litigation. So without going into any further detail and maybe leaving some of that for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the amendments that you're going to see on this bill that are critical to the settlement relate primarily to Section 2 of the bill. The first amendment is that you'll see relates to clarifying that nothing in the wildlife laws of the state would preclude the Department of Fish and Wildlife from lethally removing wolves that are in a situation of chronic depredation. And so that amendment language that you'll see further is going to clarify that the state has the authority, and that is the underlying authority that's been challenged in this litigation, which would be cured and clarified through the legislation. The other key piece of this is, aside from what the state, through the Department of Fish and Wildlife, can do to manage wolves lethally, what can individual property owners do? And that will be, that right now in the bill is subsection 4 of the bill, section 2, subsection 4. So the amended version of this is going to clarify that any time, regardless of which phase of wolf management the state is in, a landowner can use lethal actions on a wolf that is in the act of biting, wounding, or killing livestock on their property or land that they're lawfully occupying. The other key piece of the settlement is amendment language that you'll see that authorizes individuals to take lethally wolves who are chasing livestock, which goes beyond what the original Oregon Wolf Plan authorized. But I think what's different now compared to 2005 when the Wolf Plan was adopted is that we've had a number of years of not just hypothetically living with wolves as existed back then, but really living with wolves. And I think the way the language you'll see is crafted, going beyond what the Wolf Plan allows and allowing people to shoot wolves if they're chasing livestock, is not going to be something that sets back wolf populations, and it is something that gives landowners, I think, more assurances and certainty that they can protect their property when it's being challenged. There are sideboards on when that authority would exist for the chasing permitless, and this is all permitless caught in the act. Landowner wouldn't have to go through any red tape. The conditions are basically when wolves are still listed as endangered in the State Endangered Species Act, chasing authority or the authority to shoot when chasing would only exist if there's a chronic depredation situation and the landowner has previously used non-lethal means to try to deter conflict. Once wolves are no longer listed, then the authority around shooting in a chasing situation is broader than that. So those are the main amendments. There are a few others, but for the sake of time, I'll pause here, and Department of Fish and Wildlife may have additional comments, but I wanted to thank you again for the hearing today, and again, thanks to legislative leadership, and thanks to the Cattlemen's Association, the conservation group plaintiffs, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife for all of their hard work in putting their heads together on a better solution. One thing to leave on is the governor has indicated in a letter that I believe you have that he is believes the settlement is in the best interest of the state. He's very happy and complimentary of the groups for reaching agreement, and he's intent on moving the settlement and agreement forward, including legislation. The careful piece on all this is the settlement was very carefully negotiated, and I think the language that you'll see come before you is part of those careful negotiations. And so I think there's a lot of delicacy around making sure that the language that was agreed to in settlement, both on the legislation and the rule, is actually the language that gets solidified in statute and in the OARs before the governor signs any bill. So thank you again for your time, and happy to take any questions or just sit back down.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for a really remarkable piece of work. Are there any questions for this panel before we hear from other folks? Representative Dembrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I would join the chair in congratulating you and thanking you for this settlement long in coming. I'd just like a little more clarification about the situation in which an owner can to shoot a wolf that's caught in the act of chasing. And does any kind of proof have to be offered, to show that is what happened? I mean, obviously, if the wolf had bitten the animal or had, killed the livestock, there would be evidence. What is the way of ensuring that that won't be abused?
Chair Garrett and Representative Dembrough, would you like to? Sorry, Representative.
You were the one who's.
I jumped the gun.
Okay. All right. a good question, Representative. Appreciate trying to answer that question for you. The answer actually appears in both taking both consideration of Section 2 through Part 4 of Section 2
of the amendment.
1, 2, yes, of the amendment, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. And the language says the taking is allowed under the Federal Endangered Species Act of 1973, and the gray wolves are caught in the act of biting, wounding, or killing livestock or working dogs. And that hasn't been a subject of as much conversation, but the herd dogs that many of the ranchers have used to help them manage their animals in the past have come under attack by the wolves as well. And they are quite a valuable asset as far as the ranchers are concerned. That's a of of this, and then it says, caught in the act of chasing livestock or working dogs as defined by the commission. Authorization for such taking during phase one of the Oregon Wolf Conservation and Management Plan only exists if the person has, first of all, undertaken non-lethal actions. And we talked in this committee about that in a previous session when we were talking about bone piles and the removal of bone piles, which is one of the non-lethal actions that ranchers would be obligated to do. And there are in the rules and law some specific reference to that. And taking the necessary efforts that the wolf-livestock conflict, as specified by the department, and taking occurs during the time in which the department has determined a situation of chronic deprivation exists. So that, it cannot be just a random wolf attack on livestock. We have to have, and chronic deprivation is defined earlier, means at least four confirmed depredations in a six-month period of time. So there's some really pretty tight sideboards on that, that we're just not out shooting wolves who, for the most part, are nocturnal, so they're not going to be easily seen, you know, by the ranchers. But be that as it may, even if they do see them, they can't just go out and shoot them because there's a wolf out there, and they can't even shoot them just because he happens maybe to be chasing. There needs to be that chronic deprivation, you know, present in the herd.
But I guess if I could follow up.
Follow up.
There'd be no proof needed. I mean, I'm not quite sure how you would establish proof, unless you had a video camera with you, you know, that the wolf was actually chasing, you know, the livestock or the working dog. Presumably, the rancher is going to have to be taken. There's going to have to be trust involved here. Is that's how I read this.
Brett, did you want to, did that come up during then? Yeah, you may want to comment on that, because I'm sure that came up during the settlement discussion.
I'd be happy to continue with that. Mr. Chair and Representative Dembro, yes. First of all, there has to be some element of trust. I mean, that's part of what it means to live a human life. I mean, that you've got, you know, when you get in your car, you trust that the other person is going to stop at the next, at the red light that you have a green light on. And, of course, when it fails to happen, you have, you know, major problems appear. And so, yes, there is that. But there's also, I think, and Brett and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, when they come up, some other possible answers that might come forth on that or that might be important for you. And that is, there will be signs, you know, that you have the chronic deprivation. That's already documented. And the animal, if the wolf is chasing it, even if he doesn't kill it, will almost assuredly have some markings where the attack has taken place. And I guess if we want to spend enough money, you know, in challenging it, we can even probably DNA, you know, establish that if we've got, you know, this type of thing. In addition to which, those bites that might take place by a wolf are pretty easily identifiable, as contrasted to the only thing else might be a coyote, and they'd be very different type of markings, I think. And the cougar, which are guilty of depredation on some occasions, has a much different kill pattern. than the wolf has. So you got a pretty consistent pattern there that is present.
Just one last follow-up. Thank you. And I fully appreciate that. And I do believe that, you know, to a large extent, trust is going to be necessary in this situation. I'm wondering, was there any consideration of a penalty if, in fact, there was, you know, some clear, egregious violation of the, you know, the terms here where someone, you know, where there really was, you know, no evidence and no way that the landowner could have seen the wolf, you know, in the act, as it were?
Again, I think ODFMW would be able to answer some of that with more specifics maybe than I have, but we would note that the gray wolf in this part of the country is a listed species under the Oregon Endangered Species Act, and there are penalties provided in the Oregon Endangered Species Act for killing animals of that are listed by the state of Oregon.
So, and those would presumably apply?
They would apply. And I'm not an attorney nor a judge, but common sense tells me they would apply.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a simple question, and I just want to clarify that the landowner, I understand that piece, but the one that lawfully occupies land, is that occupying range land that is public lands as opposed to private lands?
Chair Garrett and Representative Holvey, yes. So it can either be an individual who is lawfully permitted to graze on public lands, or in some cases there are individuals who lease out other private land owned by another individual.
So follow-up.
Follow-up question.
So if it does include the grazing rights that someone has on public lands, how do you what's your area for determining depredation? Because I could imagine the Wallala Whitman Forest being, you know, pretty large, and so if you have four predations in a six-month period over the whole Wallala Whitman Forest, you know, I'm you know, because it's open grain rangeland, I'm wondering if there was thought put into having a different standard for open public rangelands that someone has leased as opposed to being on private lands where you have a little bit more control as a landowner. Because it seems that the wolves have to exist somewhere. And I would think that, you know, we don't want them on private lands, but in trying to keep them on public lands. So I'm just wondering if that conversation was considered and how big that area would be.
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey. So that question is getting into it's a big issue and an important issue, and it did come up during the settlement negotiations. And the way it's largely been addressed is through the administrative rule that will be adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission that has been temporarily adopted through a temporal by ODFMW's director. And I believe ODFMW can get into this more, but the general You're correct that on the public lands, it's a much bigger domain. When there's a situation of depredation, the way you would count the number of qualifying incidents of depredation within a six-month period of time would be based on ODFMW's determination of an area of depredating wolves. And so it would be based on where the first depredation occurs and what the wolves, many of these wolves have GPS collars on them or other collars, or the department may have other information on how the wolves are behaving and where they are. The department would then define an area of depredating wolves, and within that area would be where you would be looking to determine whether you have X number of depredations in a six-month period of time. And as to standards on the public, the way we discussed this and the conclusion that we got to was if you're talking about running livestock on public land,
where, you know, some might expect wolves to more likely be, and you're also talking about your livestock operation part of the year is going to be on base ranch or private land and maybe more confined in calving situations or something like that. There are different conflict deterrence methods that one would need to use or want to use. In a one-size-fits-all cookie cutter is not going to work because the public land domain is so large that certain measures such as fencing or electrified flagging just aren't going to work on public lands. And so it was recognized in the settlement negotiations and in the rule tied to settlement that on public land, a lot of times the best thing in some cases, maybe the sole thing that could be done would be to have human presence out there on those public lands, and that should count as a non-lethal deterrence method when you're evaluating whether an operator tried to do something to deter conflict prior to depredation happening. And if they're on public land, I think the department can clarify what it would be looking for, but through the talks and the settlements, that is the kind of thing that they would be asking about and looking to hear from landowners is, okay, was there any human presence out here prior to a depredation occurring on public land, while recognizing that it's going to be a whole lot harder to keep track of things and do conflict deterrence on big, wide open spaces like that.
Senator, please.
May I add one thing very quickly? Wolves tend to be territorial, and with the collared wolves, you can follow where the packs are and what their territory is. Mm-hmm. And I think that an answer further there that you've got to have the depredation within that particular area. So if a wolf is caught chasing in that area, I think you would have the evidence that it was a part of the problem pack. Or if you eliminate a wolf way out here that doesn't have the depredation, then I think you get back to that problem. That farmer is going to, it's going to be a different environment in which the lethal was done. So I think those sideboards help bring it down to general areas, whether it's public or public land. The packs tend to be in a separate way, and because they're radio collars, you can track them where they move, where they den, and the kind of the area they have. And I think that'll go a long ways to answer the question.
Representative Jensen, you want to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Folby, I think there's another factor that maybe hasn't been mentioned so far. With your question, the rancher is leasing basically that land, and I think would expect the same type of considerations that as far as his rights on the land that he might have if he were leasing it from you, sort of thing. So, he is. If he's leasing it, there's at least some sort of compensation that goes with that.
Any further discussion with this group? Thanks very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Barnhart, I didn't see your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at Section 7, subsection 7 on the second page. I think it deals with part of the issue that was raised earlier about how you figure out what actually occurred, because it requires the state police to investigate. Do we actually have enough state police officers in that part of the world to conduct this kind of investigation and do the other things they're supposed to do?
You should probably answer that, Brett.
Chair Garrett and Representative Barnhart. So without the benefit of having state police here to let us know how many officers they have out there,
I'm not sure we want to know the answer to that particular question.
I'm hearing more about the ONC counties. I'm more aware of the dire straits down there in southwest Oregon. So, but to the question and to Representative Denbrough's earlier question, yeah, that subsection 7 is where everything that Representative Jensen said is true. But the other thing that would happen here is if somebody does shoot a wolf in the act of chasing, There's an obligation in the statute here to report that action to the Department of Fish and Wildlife within 24 hours and preserve evidence, treat it like a crime scene, basically. And then the department is obligated, along with state police. And my impression is there is adequate state police presence in that part of the state to be able to join the Department of Fish and Wildlife to go out and, as state police do in any regular poaching investigation, they would be the entity to go out and investigate whether it was the shooting was in fact done based on the terms and conditions in the legislation here of there was chronic depredation, there was actual chasing, you can see tracks, for example, or wounds, and then make that determination whether there was compliance with the conditions on the act that sideboards the point that you were getting at, Representative Denbro, or whether there was a situation of poaching going on. We did talk about a penalty section in here, and the reason it's not in the legislation is in talking about this through the settlement negotiations, there is already existing state law that makes it a Class A misdemeanor for anybody who's knowingly poaching. So we didn't feel like the legislation amended language would need to duplicate existing law. But it was discussed and intended to work that way.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further? Thank you again for being here and for your work. And we look forward to getting the language back in front of us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We're in work session, but I want to offer the chance for ODF and W and anybody else, for that matter, who'd like to be heard on this. In our few remaining minutes, you're welcome to come forward and speak if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll be very brief. I know it's getting late. Certainly, the department, we've been involved in ongoing discussions over the last 17 months or so regarding this particular issue, and better part of a decade on the higher level, broader scale. Very supportive of moving forward, getting back to just fully implementing our wolf management plan, and fully supportive of the ultimate bill language, which you will see hopefully here soon in the coming days. Happy to answer any questions you might have, and I have Ron Anglin here with me, our Wildlife Division Administrator. Ron's been instrumental in the ongoing discussions with over the last year and a half.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. And you asked the question, Representative Barnhart, about OSP a second ago, and actually it would be their Fish and Wildlife Division, not the Traffic Division, that would do any investigations. And in these rural areas, we do feel that they do have the presence there to handle that. The second piece of, obviously, of all this that's tied together after the legislation or in conjunction with the legislation is permanent rules to be adopted by our commission. And our intent is to take those that are, again, the negotiated rule that came out of the settlement discussion to our commission in July. So they are, as Brett alluded to, very clearly linked together and tied together. And we appreciate your willingness to take up Representative Jensen's bill and do the modifications that would help us move forward with implementation of the plan.
Thank you both. Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so focusing on, it says that one of the conditions is the taking occurs during the time period in which the department has determined a situation of chronic depredation to exist. And then Section 2, and that references Section 2, Paragraph 2, chronic depredation means for confirmed depredations. So, one, how does the department find out about these depredations? How do you find out about that initially? And two, how do the ranchers find out that a period of chronic depredation is in place? What's the notice back and forth?
Well, Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Hicks, certainly the rancher finds out about a depredation or a possible depredation just in his daily business or his hired folks that are on the ground find dead animals or remains, and believe me, we hear about it very quickly. The word travels not just in the community but directly to us very, very quickly. We then have, actually, we have a wolf staff of two people that actually are dedicated wolf-focused specialists that actually go out and do then investigate any depredations, and they then issue their determination whether it's confirmed or possible or probable. When we get into an area where we have wolf depredations occurring, then we actually, our wolf staff and our local district staff actually designate an area of known wolf activity and an area of depredating wolves. And they do that, an area of known wolf activity based on both GPS caller information from marked wolves as well as just observation, and then area of depredating wolves is a combination of an area where depredations have occurred, but then, and that's usually a subset of a broader area of known wolf activity. So I hope that answers your question. Ron, I want to add anything to that.
Yeah, there's Chair Garrett and Representative Hicks, there's one other thing that we do as part of all that. Because of the GPS callers, we get downloads every day, and we've set up a computerized notification system for the landowners that they can sign into. We break up the wolf activity area into sub-areas, and then we notify the landowners over the previous 24 hours where the wolves had been, and then that gives them an idea on whether they need to do some additional checking on their livestock.
Well, it may go without saying, but through that system, you would then notify the landowners if a period of chronic depredation has been put into place. That's how they would find out. Is that true? Is that how they'd find out? Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, so that system is really, it's giving them almost real-time information on where we have collared wolves and where they're active, whether there's wolves in their area. They get a text or an email. Literally, I think it's four times a day they can get a text or an email that tells them if there's activity in their polygon, if you will. The broader area, we post on our website our areas of wolf activity or areas of chronic depredation. So we actually post on our website an actual map with the delineation. So that's how they would learn about it. And there is a great level of interest. You can probably imagine that folks on the ground know. They're very well in tune to what's going on.
Representative Ambrose?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm sure I know the answer to this, but if we pass this bill, this doesn't affect the compensation program that we already have in place. I assume that's true, yes?
Correct. Yeah. Chair Garrett, Representative Ambrose, that's correct. This does not affect the compensation program that's in place.
Representative Halvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have to talk with Representative Jensen to learn a little bit more about this, but I'm still, I guess I have some questions about the rangelands and the public lands, and when we have predation in those areas where there are leases running your livestock on those rangelands, is there any concern that, you know, some sort of activity to go after and kill those wolves will push those wolves into a different area, like onto private lands, for example? And I'm also second part of that question is, when you talk about the maps of where wolf activity is, where the denning areas are for wolves, I would assume that there's some sort of conversation with the federal government and the livestock owners to not lease lands where you have an obvious direct conflict that could potentially happen, where you have a denning areas. I mean, can you talk to me a little bit about those issues as I'm trying to understand this?
Sure.
Garrett, Representative Halvey, if you'd like, we can come give you a wolf one-on-one. 101.
Oh, 101, not 101.
Yeah.
I thought Jensen had already gotten
this. So you had several different questions there. First, on a wolf den site, we do not disclose where those sites are. That's very sensitive information. They are still on the state ESA, and we just don't disclose that. And the landowners are very good. They're not asking for it. We just haven't seen any conflicts there. So We are very aware and cognizant of any activities that are occurring that might displace wolves or move them around. The reality is, you know, we'd be happy if they stayed on public land all the time and never ended up on private land, but that doesn't happen that way. They'll follow deer and elk down onto winter range, which typically is on private land. So when you get into a public land grazing situation, what you have is not only deer and elk out there, but you have the livestock spread across a pretty broad area. And typically, about the time they start turning out, the early end of the turnout, you may still have wolves in the den site, but right now the den sites that we've located aren't just embedded in the middle of any of the grazing allotments. So the action then that would occur if they're out on the open grazing allotment, you know, the reality is that it can be difficult for that permittee to find and document that they've had a kill, and then for us to come out and investigate it and confirm it in a timely manner that it was in fact a wolf kill. We suspect that there are losses and that are above and beyond the normal losses that livestock owners had prior to wolves showing up on the landscape, that there are losses, but they're just never found and documented. So we haven't, in our experience, which is fairly limited, but in our experience, we haven't really found the types of concerns that you're expressing to bear out on the open range grazing allotments. We are working with the Forest Service, keeping them up to speed with the things that we're doing. But so far, the patterns that wolves have exhibited, where they really start depredating a lot, seem to occur primarily in late spring and in early fall, and they're on private land.
Follow up?
No.
Okay. Further discussion? Well, right on cue. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative Jensen, for presentation. We appreciate your work, and we'll bring this back as soon as we're able to. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 3452, and with no further business, committee is adjourned.